morning, good afternoon, whatever the case may be. My name is William McCaffrey. I'm a partner with the law firm Labatt Balkin, Calavita and Contini in New York, and my practice primarily concentrates in the area of legal malpractice defense. I represent attorneys and law firms that get sued in any manner of different actions. There's about more than 10 attorneys in my firm that do that on a regular basis, and that goes to show you, just in our firm, how many lawyers are being sued. So legal malpractice actions are prevalent. We live in a very litigious society, and I believe that they are going to get more and more prevalent as time goes on. So whether you've ever been sued or not, there's a reasonably good chance that sometime over the course of your practice, you very well may be sued, because we live in a society today where if you're in business, you're going to be sued, and attorneys are in business. So at some point in their careers, there's a reasonably good chance that they're going to be sued. So today what we'll do is go over legal malpractice actions, elements, claims, and defenses, give you a basic rundown on what legal malpractice actions are all about, and to begin with, well, I'll just note that all the different issues that we'll talk about today, the laws vary from state to state, and so we'll discuss a general overview and issues that come up in malpractice cases, but there are varying laws from state to state as to all of these particular issues. So if you have any particular issue or you need information on a particular area of law, it's important to check the law in your state and speak to an attorney in your state that practices there, because there's varying laws from state to state on all of these issues. So keep that in mind. I'm from New York, and I come from a New York perspective, but we'll go over all different aspects of these things. And in the materials, there's a case law from around the country. So let's begin. Before we get into the issues particular to malpractice actions and claims and elements and things of that nature, let me just discuss briefly some of the statistics about legal malpractice cases. And these statistics come from the American Bar Association's Lawyer Professional Liability section. They do a summary every few years on a survey every few years of malpractice statistics, and they publish that every few years. The most recent one is from is published in 2016, and the details are from 2012 through 2015. So first, legal malpractice claims by area of law. In the last few years, in that period of time, 2012 to 2015, the practice area that sees the most legal malpractice actions is plaintiff's personal injury cases. And they account for about 18.24% of all malpractice claims. Prior to that, real estate had overtaken plaintiff's personal injury. Plaintiff's personal injury is usually on top, but for a while there, after the real estate collapse in 2008, real estate took over. But now personal injury plaintiff's work is back to the top of the list with 18.24% of all claims, and real estate practice is second with 14.89% of all claims. After that is family law with 13.51%, estates, trusts, and probate with 12.05% of all claims, collections and bankruptcy, 10.59%, and then it gets smaller and smaller from there. Criminal practice, commercial business and transactions, corporate business and organization, patent, trademark, and copyright, personal injury defense, those are all around 5% or lower. But those are the highest areas of claims. So if you practice in any of those particular areas, you have a heightened likelihood of seeing a claim against you at some point. Also, there's an interesting correlation between claims that are brought in malpractice in regards to the number of attorneys that are in a firm, and by by far, solo practitioners and very small firms have the most claims brought against them. Solo practitioners account for 34.21% of all legal malpractice claims, and then small firms with 2 to 5 attorneys account for 32.03% of all malpractice claims. So with combined, either solo or up to 5 attorneys, that's more than 2/3 of all malpractice claims. And there's a number of reasons for that. Number one, maybe there's a greater percentage of attorneys practicing in that type of solo practice or small firm. But also, on a more substantive level, there is an issue with solo practitioners and small firms being overwhelmed, overworked, not properly staffed, and having to do everything themselves, and also not having colleagues around to bounce things off of or discuss issues with and all those kinds of things. So the number of attorneys in your firm and your practice also has a bearing on your likelihood of having a malpractice action brought against you. And then finally, just one final statistic that we'll discuss is legal malpractice claims by the type of alleged error. And you can find it. I'll probably have some more statistics on them in the materials, but you can find more details online if you go to the ABA website. But administrative errors account for almost 54% of all malpractice claims. So that's just simple administrative errors, misfilings, misdates, all those types of things. And then substantive errors only account for 23.15%. And then client relations issues, 13.31% of claims, and then in intentional wrongs is less than 10%. But it goes to show you, particularly with the administrative errors, that more than half of the claims that arise from administrative errors, and that's calendaring issues and things of that nature. So all of those things are very important to avoid malpractice claims. So now we'll get into the issues of the malpractice claims themselves, the elements of the claims and defenses and things of that nature. And first and foremost with any malpractice claim is the issue of privity. Before we get into some of the elements of a malpractice claim, before you a plaintiff, a former client or whatever, has a potential malpractice claim against an attorney, they have to be able to establish that there was privity between the him or her and the attorney, that there was an attorney-client relationship. And obviously that's pretty obvious in most cases where someone was represented by the attorney, they claim something went wrong, and then they bring a lawsuit. But it's not always so clear, and there are different issues in different states. So in the first issue, as to clients themselves, obviously there's an attorney-client relationship there, and there's a duty there to the client, so there's potential liability, and they can bring a cause of action. But one issue that arises is whether there needs to be an actual retainer agreement or an engagement letter with that client or something like that. And generally speaking, the answer is no. Even if there's no engagement letter or retainer agreement with a client, and a client maintains that there was an attorney-client relationship, that could still be the basis for a malpractice claim. It doesn't necessarily need to be a written agreement between you and the client. But more complicated issues become when you involve potential claims by third parties. And different states vary as to how liberal they are in allowing third parties to bring malpractice claims against attorneys. In the first instance, in New York, and I think this is pretty much the standard across the country, but sometimes third parties who don't have a specific attorney-client relationship with the attorney can bring a malpractice action against the attorney, and the standard generally is that there's either privity, which would be with a client, or a relationship so close as to approach that of privity. And there's a number of examples of how that might fit in. But for example, if an attorney is doing an opinion letter and they're hired by one party, but then that opinion is going to have a direct impact on a third party. In certain circumstances, that can be sufficient enough, close enough for a relationship to enable that third party to bring a malpractice action against the attorney. This issue of third parties also comes up in the context of trust and estates issues, and whether beneficiaries to under a will can bring an action against the attorney draftsman of the will if there was something incorrect that was done in the context of drafting that will. Some states allow beneficiaries to bring malpractice actions against the attorney. For example, if the decedent wanted the will drawn in such a way, and the attorney didn't do it that way, and as a result, the beneficiaries lost out on their inheritance or whatever, some states will allow the beneficiaries to bring a malpractice action against the attorney, but other states, including New York, won't allow the beneficiaries to bring an action against the attorney because there is no attorney-client relationship there. The beneficiaries weren't represented by the attorney, and so therefore they have no malpractice action in that way, but some states do allow it. Somewhat different than beneficiaries, but also in the trust and estates context, is an attorney's liability to the estate itself and the representatives of that estate. Again, states vary from state to state as to whether they allow executors and the estates to bring malpractice claims against the attorney draftsman, but some allow it straight out, some don't allow it at all, and then there is a gray area in the middle where sometimes it can be allowed where, for example, there was an issue with regard to estate planning that diminished the value of the estate that was done by the attorney. And under the circumstances in that gray area, courts will sometimes allow an action by the estate itself, even though the estate wasn't the client of the attorney, because it diminished the value of the estate, and that was the case while the decedent was alive as well. So there are varying issues as to whether an estate of a decedent can bring an action against the attorney draftsman, but that's an issue on the issue of liability to third parties as well. Same thing with the issue of trustees and receivers in bankruptcy. One thing to know about that is that if a client goes into bankruptcy, then that potential legal malpractice claim that they have against you as the attorney no longer belongs to them. If there's a legal malpractice claim, it belongs to the estate in bankruptcy, and so they can no longer bring the legal malpractice action against you. It's an asset of their estate, and it has to then it's owned by the trustee in bankruptcy. So one thing that we do in the context of defending malpractice cases is to look to see if there's been a bankruptcy by the client, because if the client is presently in bankruptcy, then they cannot bring the malpractice claim in their own name. It belongs to the trustee, and they have to pursue it. So the case is subject to dismissal under those circumstances. Or if there was a bankruptcy that's been resolved, but the representation was before the bankruptcy, then that legal malpractice claim belonged to the trustee, and even though it wasn't pursued by the trustee, and now the former client is pursuing the malpractice action after the resolution of the bankruptcy, it is no longer theirs, and so the case is subject to dismissal for that reason as well. Finally, on the issue of liability to third parties, some states allow legal malpractice claims to be assigned. So if you have a legal malpractice, if a client has a legal malpractice claim, and they want to sell that claim to someone to have it, have them pursue it, I think most states allow that. But that's an issue as well. I mean, it doesn't come up very often because usually it's obviously the client that's bringing the action. But from time to time, it does arise where, for one reason or another, the client has assigned the claim to somebody else for various reasons. And in some states, that's permissible. In some states, it's not. But I think in most states that it actually is. So those are the issues of
Buckeye CLE's first verification code is BEANS, B-E-A-N-S, BEANS. Buckeye CLE's first verification code is BEANS, B-E-A-N-S. Please take a moment and write this down.
Privity and attorney-client relationships. So as an outset, before any malpractice claim or action can be brought against an attorney, obviously there needs to be that issue of privity and attorney-client relationship, or as we discussed, in certain circumstances, third parties might be in a position where they might be able to bring an action against that attorney as well. But once it's established, or at least an issue of fact, as to whether there is privity or a relationship so close as to approach privity that there is a valid claim by the plaintiff against the former attorney, then the issue becomes the elements of the malpractice claim. What is it that a plaintiff needs to demonstrate in the context of a malpractice claim in order to prove the malpractice of the attorney and recover from the attorney? And generally speaking, there are three necessary elements to any legal malpractice claim, and that is negligence, proximate cause, and damages. A plaintiff generally needs to establish all three of those things in order to recover against an attorney in a legal malpractice claim. In the first instance, the first element is negligence, and that is basically the standard of care. And did the attorney fail to exercise the ordinary reasonable skill and knowledge commonly possessed by a member of the legal profession? That's basically the standard as to whether there's negligence or not. Fairly straightforward. But then there are some issues that come in that are involved with the issue of negligence. Sometimes a plaintiff will argue negligence based upon an ethical violation or a violation of a disciplinary rule or that type of thing. And in and of itself, generally speaking, for most states, an ethical violation or a violation of a disciplinary rule in and of itself isn't sufficient to give rise to a cause of action in legal malpractice. It has to be more than that. If there's an ethical violation or a violation of a disciplinary rule or something like that, that can be alleged, but that violation has to directly correlate to the cause of the alleged damages. So, for example, if there's a claim of conflict of interest, an ethical violation in that regard, it's not enough to say, hey, there was a conflict of interest, so now you have to pay me whatever. It's not enough to say that, even if it's true, even if there was a conflict of interest. They have to demonstrate that conflict of interest was the cause of the damages. For example, the attorney was conflicted, and therefore they actually represented the interests of my adversary as opposed to mine, and because my interests weren't represented properly, that caused me to sustain damages. And see, in that example, the issue really isn't the ethical violation, the conflict of interest. The real allegation of negligence there is that he didn't properly protect my interests. He was negligent in that regard. So it really, that example comes down to a negligence claim. But generally speaking, that's how it arises. If it's just a flat out allegation of an ethical violation or a violation of a disciplinary rule, that in and of itself won't be cause for a malpractice claim. They have to correlate it to something else, that the violation led to the malpractice, that it was in some way caused, it was contributed to the negligence, or was part and parcel of the negligence that caused the damages. So in and of itself, it's insufficient. The next element of the malpractice claim is proximate cause. And there's a couple of issues with regard to proximate cause. In the most simple example, the plaintiff in a legal malpractice action generally has to demonstrate that but for the attorney's alleged negligence, they would have prevailed in their case, or they wouldn't have sustained damages in the underlying action or matter or transaction, whatever the case may be. But that proximate cause in many cases, many legal malpractice cases, equates to that but-for issue. Proximate cause being the plaintiff wouldn't have sustained damages but for the alleged negligence of the attorney. So that's the first instance. So, for example, if there's a plaintiff's personal injury case and the case of the underlying case is lost, the attorney missed the statute of limitations or something like that, if the attorney, in the context of defending the malpractice claim, can demonstrate that the plaintiff wouldn't have prevailed in the personal injury case anyway, for one reason or another, then the attorney can move for summary judgment or a dismissal in that case on the grounds that, okay, while I may have been negligent in failing to file before the statute of limitations expired, the plaintiff wouldn't have prevailed in that case anyway, so they have no damages. So they wouldn't have prevailed in the underlying case but for my negligence, and therefore they can't maintain a legal malpractice action against me. That's one issue of the proximate cause. And then a second issue of proximate cause is the case within a case. And that's similar to what we were just discussing, but somewhat different. A legal malpractice action is a case within a case, so the plaintiff, in the context of a legal malpractice action, has to be able to demonstrate that they would have prevailed in their case or had a better result in their case, but for the alleged malpractice of the attorney. So the legal malpractice action can become a case within a case if there is a if there's no issue of the attorney's negligence, for example, then the attorney basically steps into the shoes of the opposing party in the underlying matter. And the plaintiff has to demonstrate what the outcome of that underlying matter would have been, and the attorney is in the position of arguing the opposite. That if it was a litigation, the plaintiff obviously is going to argue that he or she would have prevailed, and the attorney steps into the shoes of the defendant in that case and argues on all the merits of what the underlying case was, but the plaintiff wouldn't have prevailed. And the same thing with regard to whether it's a transactional matter or whatever the case may be. If the plaintiff is alleging they lost out because of some issue of the contract and they blame that on the alleged negligence of the attorney is free to step into the shoes of the opposing party and say, hey, no, you wouldn't have been able to purchase the property or whatever the case may be under these circumstances. You breached the contract yourself or whatever the case may be. So an issue of proximate cause on the legal malpractice actions is that issue of a case within a case, and the attorney basically steps into the shoes of the opposing party in the underlying case and is free to defend the underlying case to demonstrate that the plaintiff either didn't sustain any damages because they wouldn't have prevailed as they claim they would have, or the extent of those damages. So if maybe there is an issue that there was negligence and there was damages, but and the plaintiff says, hey, if this contract went through, I would have been able to realize $1 million profit or whatever the case may be, the attorney can step into the shoes of the opposing party in the underlying transaction and demonstrate, no, if that had happened, you wouldn't have sustained $1 million you claim. There were issues there that you wouldn't have been able to make that much money, and you would have recovered something, but it wouldn't have been that much money. So the attorney steps into the shoes of the underlying party or the opposing party in the matter and can defend the case that way as well, and that's under the guise of proximate cause. The next element, the final element to the malpractice claim is damages. And in order to prevail in the malpractice claim, the client, the former client, the plaintiff, has to demonstrate not only was the attorney negligent, but that he or she sustained actual, real damages. Not, they can't be speculative or anything like that. They have to be able to demonstrate that there was actual real damages that resulted from the alleged malpractice. And generally, the measure of damages in a malpractice case, in a legal malpractice case, is the value of the claim that was lost, or what they would have recovered but for the attorney's alleged negligence. So these are... the damages in a legal malpractice case are essentially what would have been recovered in the underlying case. They don't get any special bonus because it's a malpractice claim. They don't get, as we were discussing a minute ago, since it's a case within a case, they don't get more than they, if they say, hey, I would have been able to recover $1 million, but for the negligence, they don't necessarily get to recover that. They have to demonstrate what they actually would have recovered, and the attorney, in the context of the defense of the claim, can demonstrate, can present evidence and demonstrate, no, you wouldn't have made that recovery. So the damages in a legal malpractice action are generally the value of the loss of the claim, the damages that they sustained that wouldn't have been incurred but for the attorney's alleged negligence. As some case law says, the object of compensatory damages is to make the injured client whole. Where the injury suffered is the loss of a cause of action, the measure of damages is generally the value of the claim lost. And that's what's generally recoverable in the context of a legal malpractice action. And as I said a moment ago, a subset of that is actual damages. They have to be real, actual, ascertainable. They can't be theoretical. If the plaintiff says, hey, I probably would have recovered this much or whatever, that's not going to be actionable. They have to be able to demonstrate. Sometimes there can be an issue of fact as to whether they would have recovered something or not. But there are some times where the plaintiff alleges speculative damages, that they would have, you know, that they believe they would have recovered this, but maybe that's based upon, you know, what other parties would have done, and they're basically then hypothesizing about what other parties would have done and what would have resulted, and generally they're not permitted to do that in the context of a legal malpractice action. They have to demonstrate that there were real, actual, ascertainable damages that resulted from the malpractice, and if they can't demonstrate that, then the claim is subject to dismissal. Another issue is the issue of collectability under the element of damages. For example, if the if the underlying matter was litigation, the most basic example is always like a plaintiff's personal injury case. If a plaintiff had a client had a personal injury case, and the attorney missed the statute of limitations, and say, for example, the plaintiff can demonstrate that, yeah, the attorney was negligent, that they missed the statute of limitations, and they can prove the case within a case that the underlying, the other driver would have been responsible for the accident. They blew a stop sign, they blew a red light, whatever the case may be, they were totally responsible for it, they rear-ended the plaintiff, whatever. Even if they can demonstrate all of those things, one aspect of a malpractice claim is collectability. Would the plaintiff, the client, have been able to recover the damages that they claim they sustained? So in the example I gave, if the driver of the other car didn't have insurance and has absolutely no assets or anything of that nature, while the accident may have been the other driver's fault in entirety, if the plaintiff could not have made a recovery for the damages, then they haven't sustained actual damages. And again, a case like that is subject to dismissal as well, because even though there was malpractice and even though plaintiff would have prevailed in the underlying case, if the plaintiff couldn't have made a recovery in the underlying case, then there were no damages. Similarly, if there is some reason why damages in the underlying case would have been limited, even though the plaintiff's claim damages may be, like I said, $1 million, if in the context of the example we're discussing, the opposing driver only had a $100,000 insurance policy and had no assets above that that could have been collected directly from that opposing driver personally, then while the plaintiff may claim, hey, I have $1 million worth of damages, if plaintiff only would have been able to recover $100,000 in the underlying case, then in most states, the damages are going to be limited in the legal malpractice action to that $100,000 that they would have been able to collect. That's generally true in most states. There is an issue from state to state and in New York between different departments in the state as to whether that issue of collectability is something that the plaintiff has to prove affirmatively, or whether that's an affirmative defense that has to be demonstrated by the attorney in defense of the claim. So that's a distinction as well, whose burden it is to prove the collectability issue. But certainly collectability is an issue under the element of damages, whether it would have been able to be collected or not. Next under damages is the issue of recovering legal fees. Sometimes the there's obviously, in the context of United States law, the plaintiff in a case or the prevailing party in a case isn't able to collect legal fees from the other side. Somewhat distinct from that is an issue in legal malpractice actions. While in the context of a legal malpractice action, the plaintiff can't recover legal fees for his or her attorney's prosecution of the legal malpractice claim, what they can sometimes recover is legal fees that were expended with regard to the underlying matter that gave rise to the malpractice claim, that were incurred in an effort to correct the attorney's malpractice, or legal fees that wouldn't have been incurred in the underlying matter but for the attorney's alleged malpractice. And so, for example, if a client a case is dismissed by the trial court, and then they fire that attorney and they hire a new attorney to bring an appeal of that decision, and the new attorney prevails on the appeal and the case is reinstated, under those circumstances, if the original dismissal was resulted from the first attorney's negligence, then under those circumstances, the plaintiff could bring a malpractice action against the attorney, saying, "I incurred damages as a result of your negligence, and my damages were the cost of the appeal that I had to do that I wouldn't have incurred if you didn't, improperly oppose the motion to dismiss at the trial court level, or whatever the case may be." So while attorneys' fees, legal fees, aren't generally recovered in the context of our system, if they were incurred as a result of the malpractice of the attorney to correct the malpractice, or something that wouldn't have been incurred but for the malpractice, that sort of thing, then those legal fees can be recoverable in the context of a legal malpractice action. But the actual legal fees of the attorney that's prosecuting the claim for the former client, those legal fees aren't recoverable. But like I said, if there were others that were incurred because of the attorney's negligence, then those can be recovered. This also can be an issue as to whether there should be an offset of legal fees. For example, if, again, the simplest example is like a plaintiff's personal injury case. If a plaintiff has a personal injury case that's worth $99,000, and they had a one-third contingency fee with the attorney, and so the attorney would have recovered $33,000. This issue, again, I'm sure it differs from state to state, but generally, under those circumstances, an attorney may try to argue, well, hey, your recovery wouldn't have been $99,000 because I would have had my attorney's fee. Your recovery really only is $66,000, so you shouldn't recover $99 from me. You should only recover $66 because you would have had to pay me $33. Courts don't generally buy that. They basically say that the attorney's fees that you would have paid in the context of a contingency fee like that is offset by the attorney's fees that you are paying your present attorney in the context of the legal malpractice action. And I believe that's generally the approach from state to state. But that probably may differ on occasion as well. On the next issue of damages is claims for emotional distress and mental suffering and things of that nature. Oftentimes, a client will bring that type of claim in the context of a legal malpractice action. I sustained these damages, and I also sustained emotional distress as a result of this. It, you know, caused all these problems for me, and whatever the case may be. Again, while the law may differ from state to state as to whether that's recoverable, generally speaking, something like that isn't recoverable in the context of a legal malpractice action. As I said earlier, the nature of a legal malpractice action, the damages recoverable are compensatory damages, what they would have recovered in the underlying matter, but for the alleged negligence. And so you're dealing with basically a property damage type case, the value of something. And so in that context, generally speaking, a client, even if they, were an emotional wreck as a result of all of the things that transpired, generally speaking, they're not going to be able to recover on that type of claim because it's not compensatory. It's really, essentially a personal injury type of claim, which is not part and parcel of the malpractice claim, which is basically just a damages issue as to what the value that was lost. From time to time, a plaintiff in a malpractice action will seek punitive damages against an attorney. That comes up on a fairly regular basis. And again, that issue will vary from state to state, as most of these things will. But generally speaking, while a plaintiff can assert a claim for punitive damages, it's obviously a high bar for a plaintiff to recover for punitive damages in any case, but also in the case of a legal malpractice case. They have to demonstrate that there was a high degree of moral turpitude and wanton dishonesty in order to recover punitive damages. That's, generally the standard that they'll have to demonstrate. And in the context of your run-of-the-mill legal malpractice claim, that's not the situation. There was no, moral turpitude, wanton dishonesty. There is no some egregious act on the part of the attorney, and generally speaking. Obviously, the issue of most of these cases is some issue of alleged negligence, that the attorney failed to do something, that they made a mistake, or whatever the case may be. And obviously, under those circumstances, that doesn't rise to the level of punitive damages. Of course, there are occasions from time to time where, and you read the issues in the newspaper where an attorney will do something that's so outrageous or something of that nature. Obviously, under rare circumstances, there may be an occasion where punitive damages can be recovered because of some extreme act of an attorney, but that is the extreme rare circumstance. Obviously, in the context of malpractice cases, we're dealing with issues of negligence and just something went wrong, and that obviously doesn't rise to the level of an award of punitive damages. In addition to, common law issues of punitive damages, from state to state, there are also statutory damages that can be imposed for certain acts by an attorney. In New York, there's a judiciary law section 487, which allows for treble damages under certain circumstances. Obviously, I won't get into that here because it's not New York. Everyone's not from New York. But from state to state, there may be statutes that impose certain liability and damages, and essentially punitive damages on an attorney for certain acts. But in those cases, again, as with New York and the Judiciary Law Section 487 claim, it is very difficult for a client to demonstrate that and make a recovery for treble damages under the statutory rules, because they are very stringent. But that is also an issue of potential damages, of punitive damages. And then finally, on the issue of damages, is an issue of interest. Again, this varies state to state as well, but in many states, in a legal malpractice action, a plaintiff, if they make a recovery against the attorney, is entitled to pre-judgment interest on the recovery. And what that means is, if you, as the attorney, were negligent in failing to commence an action timely on behalf of your client, in 2015, and they bring a lawsuit against you, and they make a, you know, the case goes to trial, whatever the case may be, and they make a recovery against you of $100,000 in 2020, then in some states, there's prejudgment interest. Normally, generally speaking, in most cases, when there's an award made at trial, whatever the case may be, and there's a judgment issued and entered, then judgment, the interest on that judgment will begin to run from the time the judgment is entered. But in many states, in New York included, there on legal malpractice cases, a plaintiff is generally entitled to prejudgment interest. And the states can vary as to when that judgment, when that interest begins to run. Sometimes it can be from the date of the malpractice. Other can be from the date that an award would have been given, various other things. But, for example, if there's a $100,000 recovery in 2020 and the malpractice was in 2015, in states where the prejudgment interest will begin to run from the date of the malpractice, then not only is the attorney going to be on the hook for the $100,000 in damages, but they're going to be on the hook for interest on those damages from, in my example, the date of the malpractice. So the attorney would not only be on the hook, in my example, for the $100,000 of damages, but also 5 years of interest on those damages. And the reason for that essentially is because this is a monetary claim. This is a like essentially a property damage claim. So for the purposes of the action, the plaintiff incurred monetary damages back at the time they did incur those damages, and so they lost out on having the use in, of that money from that period of time. So when it's ultimately determined that, yes, you did lose out on that recovery, or you did lose that money as a result of the attorney's negligence, you lost it back then, and so you're entitled to interest on that money from when that negligence occurred. So that can significantly add up in the context of a legal malpractice case. If you're in a state that allows for prejudgment interest, as is New York, interest is statutory, and states have various interest amounts, but in New York it's a ridiculously high 9%, so 9% per year. So, in the context of the case example I gave, if the plaintiff made a recovery of $100,000 over the course of 5 years of interest, they're entitled to almost $50,000 worth of interest on that, which is, you know, almost half of the recovery that they were making in the first place. And when you're dealing with more significant damages, and even, you know, sometimes cases can go for a long period of time for one reason or another, those prejudgment interest damages can significantly accrue and add to the potential damages that the attorney is facing. So that's really the main issues of a legal malpractice case. Again, the issue of privity before you even get to the issues of elements, and then the elements themselves, negligence, proximate cause, and damages, and all the subset issues that we discussed within them. What we'll discuss next is defenses to the legal malpractice actions, and there are a number. Obviously, each case differs from case to case, and there may be any number of potential defenses that could be asserted in the context of a legal malpractice case. But we'll discuss some of the more common defenses that arise. As I noted before, in the context of a legal malpractice action, the malpractice action is a case within a case. And so whatever defenses would have been available with regard to the underlying matter are available to the attorney in the context of the legal malpractice action. So as far as defenses, again, it's a case within a case, so all the defenses that would have been available in the underlying matter are available to the attorney in the legal malpractice case. So that's first and foremost a significant defense in the context of any case. And as I mentioned, every legal malpractice case is different because they arise from whatever area of the law the attorney is practicing in. So the attorney may be practicing in real estate or personal injury matters or bankruptcy or matrimonial or, you know, anything under the sun. So in the context of defending the underlying matter, obviously all of those issues differ. And so what we'll discuss is some of the defenses that are common to most claims that might be legitimate defenses to a malpractice claim. First and foremost is statute of limitations. And again, state by state, each state is different. And in the materials, I have a rundown of the statute of limitations on all 50 states. These things change from time to time, and there are nuances within that. So, the extent you want to look at that for some guidance, it's in the materials, but, you should double-check to make sure the law hasn't changed or that there's not some particular nuance in your case that may affect it. But every state is different as far as the statute of limitations for a malpractice action. In New York, it's 3 years. In other states, it's 2 years. It varies from state to state. And there are issues with regard to when that statute of limitations begins to run, and we'll discuss that in a minute. But first and foremost, there are, in the context of defenses to malpractice cases, there is a statute of limitations, and so that can be a primary defense if the plaintiff has blown the statute of limitations. One issue within the statute of limitations is the accrual date. When does the statute begin to run? And from state to state, it varies. In New York, for example, it's a pretty strict rule that favors attorneys. And in New York, the statute of limitations on a legal malpractice action begins to run, generally speaking, from the date of the malpractice. And so that means if an attorney did something wrong and was negligent in some way, and the plaintiff may have a cause of action against that attorney for that, the 3-year statute in New York begins to run we'll get into some of the exceptions in a minute, but the statute of limitations for that begins to run on the date of the malpractice, even though the plaintiff may not even know it. In other states, the statute of limitations will begin to run from the date of the plaintiff became aware of the malpractice. In other states, there are issues as to when damages accrued. For example, if there was malpractice in the context of an underlying litigation, but that litigation is ongoing, the plaintiff may not have, even though there was malpractice, the plaintiff may not actually have damages until that litigation is resolved, and then they can say, hey, I lost the case because of your negligence, or I would have made a greater recovery but for your negligence. That is, until the damages are determined, only then in some states will the statute of limitations begin to run. So there's a number of different factors that can go into it, and each state differs from state to state as to when the accrual of that statute of limitations is and when the statute begins to run as against an attorney. But from that date, whether from state to state, whatever it may be, then the plaintiff has a certain period of time within which to bring the action. If they don't, the case is subject to dismissal. As I mentioned, some states have a discovery rule as far as when the malpractice is discovered by the client, and in other states that's not even the case. An issue as to when the statute begins to run, as I mentioned, in some states it begins to run when the malpractice is committed, when there was negligence. But a caveat to that is something called the continuous representation doctrine. And what that means is if an attorney is negligent in the context of the representation of the client in some manner while he or she is representing the client, maybe at that point in time, the attorney was negligent and the client may sustain damages at that point as a result, whatever the case may be. If the attorney continues to represent the client after that date, then, generally speaking, the statute of limitations against the attorney isn't going to begin to run until the attorney's representation of the client is over. So if there's malpractice in the middle of the representation, even though in some states the statute of limitations might begin to run ordinarily at the date of the malpractice, if that attorney continues to represent the client beyond that, in the context of the underlying matter, then the statute of limitations won't begin to run until that attorney-client relationship is over, until that representation is over, and then the statute of limitations will begin to run. And the general idea behind that is that the client wouldn't have an opportunity to understand that there was any issue until the representation was concluded, things of that nature. So that can be a tolling issue on the statute of limitations. As I mentioned, while if the attorney continues to represent the client in the underlying matter, that may be a toll for the statute of limitations. If the attorney gets off the case and a new attorney comes on the case, then again, depending on the state, simply because the underlying matter is ongoing doesn't necessarily mean that the statute of limitations is told. Like I said, in New York, for example, the statute of limitations generally begins to run from the date of the malpractice. So if the attorney got off the file at that point in time and a new attorney continued the representation, the statute would begin to run. But as I mentioned, in other states, if it's not until actual damages are accrued and things of that nature, then that may act as a toll. But that's a factor to consider in the context of whether the action is brought timely or not. There's also an issue as to whether the attorney of fraudulent concealment, whether the attorney concealed the malpractice from the client. And again, this differs from state to state as well, but if there was an active concealment of the malpractice, so as the client couldn't know that there was a potential malpractice claim against the attorney, then that may act as a toll that may act as a toll of the statute of limitations beginning to run if the attorney actively concealed the malpractice from the client. In some states, however, that's not the case, and there's a difference between active concealment and simply not telling your client you did something wrong. And for example, in New York, simply because you don't tell the client that there was malpractice does not prevent the statute from beginning to run. In other states, though, it does. So, but that's a factor to consider as well, whether the client was made aware of it in certain states or not, or whether there was active concealment of it or not. Secondly, as a defense to a malpractice claim, is the issue of privity. And we discussed that earlier, at the beginning of the discussion, with regard to an attorney-client relationship, and there has to be one, like we discussed, or under some certain circumstances, there may be limited circumstances where a third party can have privity or near privity with the attorney, but there are any number of circumstances where a plaintiff brings a malpractice action against the attorney, and for one reason or another, there really isn't privity between that plaintiff and the attorney, which can make the case subject to dismissal. For example, if the attorney is representing a corporation with regard to some underlying matter, and then an action is brought against the attorney by that corporation's owner, it may be legitimate that the legitimate defense that may make the case subject to dismissal that the owner has no privity as an individual with the attorney, that the attorney was hired by the corporation, and so the attorney's relationship is with that corporation, not with this individual owner. And so issues of privity like that can arise and be defenses to malpractice actions. Excuse me. Also, there's a somewhat different but similar is an issue of standing, whether the particular plaintiff in the case has standing to bring the malpractice case against the attorney. Thinking off the top of my head, probably an example of that would be if an attorney is representing a client with regard to some matter, but that attorney is paid by some third party. Someone's paying for the legal fees on behalf of the plaintiff, on the behalf of the client, and then the attorney does something wrong or whatever the case may be, and that person who was paying the legal fees brings an action against the attorney saying, you know, hey, you blew it and I paid you all this money, whatever. That person won't have standing to bring that action because they weren't actually the client. So then there's any number of other examples as to the issue of standing. But in the example I gave, that party doesn't have standing to bring the action because there's no attorney-client relationship there. It doesn't matter that they were paying the bills. They weren't actually the client. And again, that may be something that changes from state to state, but that's generally the overarching rule. And there's other issues with regard to standing as well, but that arises as a potential defense in the context of these cases also. Also a defense to a legal malpractice action is the issue of a professional judgment rule. Attorneys aren't expected to be infallible and know everything and make every decision correctly. There's any number of times where an attorney is acting reasonably in the context of his representation, but the decision that's made ultimately turns out to be incorrect. Maybe in the context of a trial, you decide that you're not going to call a particular witness for one reason or another, or maybe you select a particular expert over another, whatever the case may be. If that ultimately turns out to be, you know, in retrospect, a wrong decision, that, wow, we should have called that witness, or we should have hired a different expert, or whatever the case may be, and the client is alleging that the case was lost because of those mistakes, there's a principle called the professional judgment rule. And what that allows for is just that. It allows for the attorney not to be infallible. The understanding that the attorney is permitted in his professional judgment to make decisions over the course of a case. And if the attorney chooses a reasonable option of a number of reasonable options, then the attorney generally can't be held liable for making that determination. He or she is protected by that professional judgment rule. An issue can occur with that, which is important to note, is an issue of informed consent. And while the attorney has an opportunity to, make reasoned, rational judgments and decisions over the course of a case, sometimes there may be an issue of informed consent where if the attorney made a decision, but it should have been with the input of the client, then maybe the professional judgment rule won't exactly apply. There could be an issue that the attorney made this decision without the client's informed consent, and the client can say he or she would not have agreed to that course of action or whatever the case may be. And that could put a limitation on the attorney judgment rule. But in general terms, reasonable and rational judgments made in the course of a case aren't actionable. another issue is the client's subsequent representation by another attorney. This touches on the issue of proximate cause that we discussed as an element earlier. If an attorney is representing a client, and then that attorney gets off the case and then is represented by a subsequent attorney, if something went wrong with regard to the original attorney's representation, but the subsequent attorney had an opportunity to correct that mistake, then the mistake of the original attorney isn't a proximate cause of the alleged damages, because there, after the representation ended, there was an opportunity to correct the malpractice or the error. As an example of that is in the context of, let's say, a personal injury action. If you're in a state where there's a 3-year statute of limitations for a personal injury action, if the plaintiff retains an attorney initially, and that attorney handles the case for 2 years and never brings the lawsuit on behalf of the plaintiff, and then the plaintiff says, the client says, hey, this guy's doing nothing, I'm going to go get a new lawyer. He gets rid of that lawyer, gets a new lawyer, and that lawyer has the case now for a year.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is the word master. M-A-S-T-E-R, master. Esquire CLE's second verification code is the word master. M-A-S-T-E-R, master.
Year, but doesn't file the lawsuit on behalf of the plaintiff, and now the statute of limitations is missed. Well, the plaintiff can't recover from both of those attorneys saying, hey, there's a 3-year statute of limitations. The first attorney had the case for 2 years, and he didn't bring it, so he's 2/3 responsible, and the second attorney had the case for 1 year, so he's 1/3 responsible for missing the statute. No, under circumstances like that, where there's an opportunity for the subsequent attorney to protect the client's interests or correct the issue, then any malpractice or error of the first attorney isn't the proximate cause of the damages, because the subsequent attorney had the opportunity to protect the client's interests. So under those circumstances, if both attorneys were sued, the first attorney should be able to get that case dismissed as against him or her on the grounds that his alleged negligence wasn't the proximate cause of the damages, that the subsequent attorney's failure to commence it when he or she had sufficient time was the proximate cause of the damages. And so that's an issue of proximate cause on when there's subsequent representation involved. A further defense is something that we discussed earlier, is the issue of speculative damages. Sometimes a plaintiff will bring an action and say, hey, I would have made a recovery because this, that, and the other thing would have happened. But if they can't demonstrate that there were actual damages, if their damages are based upon speculation of future events, on the speculation of the actions that other parties would have taken, those things are generally speculative and can't be the basis of a recovery. We also mentioned earlier another defense is the issue of collectability. As I mentioned earlier, sometimes that's something the plaintiff has to prove, but in other circumstances in different jurisdictions, that's an affirmative defense that the defense has to show. But if it can be demonstrated that the legal malpractice plaintiff would not have made a recovery in the underlying matter, then that's a legitimate defense to the malpractice claim, and that makes the claim subject to dismissal. There's a number of other issues as well. An issue that arises in the context of these cases also is an issue of res judicata, or claim preclusion. And one issue to think about with that is this. Sometimes an attorney will bring a fee action against a client, or in the context of in handling the matter, they're awarded a legal fee by the judge that's involved in the underlying case, whatever the case may be. Generally speaking, and this may differ from state to state as well, but if an attorney is awarded a legal fee, then that conclusively demonstrates that there was no malpractice. Because if there was malpractice, an attorney is not entitled to his legal fee. So if in the context of some fee hearing or whatever the case may be, the attorney is awarded legal fees against that client, and then that client sometime later says, hey, you blew my case, you did this wrong and that wrong, and I sustained damages, and they bring a lawsuit against you, you can move to have that action dismissed on the grounds of res judicata, because the issue of malpractice has already been conclusively determined. You were awarded legal fees, and if there was any negligence, you wouldn't have been awarded the legal fees. So it conclusively demonstrates that there was no malpractice, and the action is subject to dismissal. Another issue related to that is an issue of collateral estoppel or issue preclusion. And in the context of a legal malpractice case, the issue of collateral estoppel or issue preclusion arises from time to time in what happened in the underlying matter. So, for example, if there was a determination, if you're representing a client in an underlying litigation, for example, and in some way there's a holding in the underlying case that, for example, the client's case is without merit or whatever the case may be, then that determination that's against the plaintiff, against the client, is collateral estoppel against that party. That issue, the issue of merit or whatever it may be, and there could be various issues in the context of any particular case, but if there have been issues in the underlying matter that have been decided against the client, if that client then brings a legal malpractice action and alleges all of these issues, the case in its entirety can be subject to dismissal, or particular claims within the case can be subject to dismissal because of rulings that were made in the context of the underlying case, because those rulings that are adverse to the plaintiff act as collateral estoppel against that plaintiff and can be used to dismiss the entire case at times or issues within the case. Related to that is the issue of representation with regard to criminal matters. Generally speaking, in the context of malpractice actions that arise from criminal representation, usually the standard is that in order for a client to sue an attorney for malpractice with regard to a criminal representation, which arises from time to time, where an attorney is representing a plaintiff in a criminal proceedings, and that person is convicted, goes to jail, whatever the case may be, and then he sues the attorney saying, "Hey, because of your negligence, I'm sitting here in jail, and but for your negligence, I would have won the case. I would have been out." In most jurisdictions, in order to pursue a claim for malpractice for a wrongful conviction, for example, the client first has to have that conviction overturned, and that client can't bring the malpractice action against the attorney until that conviction is overturned, because it's collateral estoppel against the client that hey, you were convicted and you did these crimes and you're convicted for them. So unless and until that's overturned, you can't demonstrate that the attorney did something wrong because you actually did those crimes. And so that's another issue with regard to collateral estoppel that arises in some cases. Another issue which is sometimes a potential defense is the effect of a prior settlement. So from time to time, a client may have had a case and maybe there was negligence, but then maybe the underlying case continued and then they settled that case. So they made some recovery in that case. It occurs from time to time where an attorney will argue, "Hey, you settled that case, you made your recovery, you can't bring the malpractice action against me now because you have no damages, you settled that case." Well, if they settled the case and they actually, in fact, made a complete recovery for their damages, then under those circumstances, then they have no damages. But a plaintiff can say, "Hey, that I mitigated my damages, that I was entitled to a recovery of $100,000 in the underlying case, but because of your negligence, I probably wasn't going to be able to prevail, so I settled the case for $50,000. And under those circumstances, it's basically the plaintiff mitigating the damages. And then if they can demonstrate that they would have had a greater recovery but for the negligence, then they can pursue a legal malpractice action against the attorney saying that my recovery would have been greater. There are also some issues that arise in the context of defenses in regards to the prematurity of an action. Again, states differ, but as I was discussing before, in certain circumstances, you need to have, the elements of the case are negligence, proximate cause, and damages. If the underlying matter is ongoing and there's no resolution to the underlying matter, then it may be an open question as to whether the plaintiff, in fact, has any damages or will incur any damages or whatever the case may be. And under those circumstances, if the action is still pending, the underlying matter is still pending, and it's an open question whether there will be any damages as a result of the attorney's alleged malpractice, then there's an issue, a potential issue of prematurity of the case, that, hey, this plaintiff may make a full recovery in the context of the underlying action, and therefore they presently can't establish damages. Generally speaking, the court won't dismiss a case based upon that because, you know, the underlying case may not be resolved for some time, and maybe the statute would run under those circumstances. But a case may be stayed under certain circumstances where the underlying matter is ongoing and the plaintiff can't demonstrate damages until that matter is resolved. Finally, on the issue of defenses, we'll discuss some of the additional causes of action that attorneys clients bring in the context of malpractice cases. But in addition to a standard legal malpractice claim, oftentimes plaintiffs will assert a number of other causes of action in the context of a complaint. Could be they may style the one cause of action as legal malpractice, and then another as negligence, another as breach of contract, another as breach of fiduciary duty, another as fraud, whatever the case may be. Generally speaking, and there can be distinctions, and it also may differ from state to state. But generally speaking, if the plaintiff asserts a legal malpractice cause of action or a negligence cause of action, whatever the case may be, and then alleges a number of other causes of action that are basically exactly the same as the malpractice claim, all of those subsequent claims are generally subject to dismissal because they're duplicative of the actual claim, which is legal malpractice. So if they allege one cause of action for legal malpractice and then negligence, breach of contract, breach of fiduciary duty, whatever the case may be, a motion can be made to dismiss all those other causes of action. And generally the standard is whether those other causes of action arise from the same facts and seek the same damages. If they arise from the same facts and they seek the same damages, then they're generally speaking duplicative of the malpractice claim, and all those additional causes of action are subject to dismissal. And that occurs in cases over and over again. There are certain limited exceptions where a case where there may actually be a distinction between an allegation of malpractice and an allegation of fraud, for example, and then under those rare circumstances they may allow the fraud cause of action to remain, and other potential causes of action that, you know, might have some distinction. But generally speaking, all of those causes of action are often duplicative and are subject to dismissal. And so those are basic defenses. Those are the common defenses to many of the legal malpractice actions. And then let me just sum up and conclude with just some additional discussion of some additional claims like we talked about that can arise, and then some just other considerations to think about. Like I said, in addition to a malpractice claim, a simple legal malpractice claim, cause of action, plaintiffs will often raise additional causes of action, and they may style it as negligence. If they have a malpractice claim and a negligence claim, then that one is subject to dismissal. It's basically duplicative and means the same thing. They may assert a breach of contract claim, and states may differ on this, but in the past, for example, in New York, a client could. Now there's a flat 3-year statute of limitations for legal malpractice in New York, regardless of what context you're alleging it as, breach of contract or whatever the case may be. But in New York, there for malpractice actions like this, there's a 3-year statute of limitations. But for breach of contract actions, generally there's a 6-year statute of limitations. So years ago, before the law was changed, plaintiffs could try to sneak in on a breach of contract cause of action. If they missed the original 3 years, they could try to sneak in and say, no, I have 6 years under a breach of contract, and then it might be an issue. And so other states may have that similar type of of distinction, so it's important to note if there is some ability for a plaintiff to sneak in under some other cause of action. But generally, the breach of contract is essentially the same claim as the negligence claim or the malpractice claim. And then the plaintiffs will often assert a breach of fiduciary duty claim, which essentially, again, is duplicative of the issue of malpractice or negligence. It's just said a different way, that you had a duty to me to do X, Y, and Z, and you failed to do it. Well, that's essentially negligence. I mentioned earlier the issue of fraud. That actually can be... Usually it's duplicative of the malpractice claim and it's subject to dismissal, but it gets asserted in many cases for one reason or another. And in rare circumstances, there may be a distinction between the malpractice claim and the fraud claim. And if there is a distinction that can be made by the plaintiff, then that fraud claim may not be subject to dismissal as duplicative if they can say, no, there's a distinct claim for the fraud, and that resulted in different damages from the malpractice claim. That can arise on rare circumstances, in which case then that might not be duplicative, and they may be able to pursue that. Other causes of action that arise in the context of these cases that essentially are duplicative of the malpractice claim itself is aiding and abetting. And they may allege against the attorney that they aided and abetted a fraud, or they aided and abetted a breach of fiduciary duty on the part of some other party. Again, generally that's going to be duplicative of the malpractice claim and subject to dismissal. But from time to time it may be distinct from malpractice and may be a separate cause of action. And those issues can be complicated in demonstrating and arguing that that there was no aiding and abetting and things of that nature. So from time to time that issue arises and might not be dismissible as duplicative. Another claim that comes up from time to time in the context of these cases is conspiracy. They allege that the attorney conspired with other parties to defraud the plaintiff or whatever the case may be. State to state differs as to whether there's a cause of action for conspiracy in and of itself. Generally speaking, there's no independent cause of action for conspiracy. But if there is some underlying cause of action, some underlying tort, then maybe there is some valid cause of action for conspiracy. And again, that's something that might be slightly distinguishable from actual malpractice, and so might not be subject to dismissal as duplicative. We discussed earlier the issue of conflict of interest. Sometimes that's raised as a separate cause of action. Again, that's really an ethical violation or a breach of a disciplinary rule or whatever the case may be. And so that's generally subject to dismissal because it's duplicative of the actual negligence claim. And as I mentioned earlier, generally speaking, an ethical violation or a violation of a disciplinary rule, that type of thing, in and of itself generally doesn't give rise to a cause of action for malpractice. I mentioned earlier also as for defenses that usually in most states, emotional distress, mental suffering, and things of that nature aren't valid causes of action. Obviously, that's a distinct claim from malpractice, so they may allege that as a separate cause of action. And it occurs from time to time that they do allege that kind of claim for emotional distress or mental suffering. But generally speaking, in most jurisdictions, that should be dismissed, even though that might not particularly be duplicative of the malpractice claim. Generally speaking, that's not allowed, so that cause of action can be dismissed on motion. Finally, just some procedural matters to consider. In some states, an affidavit of merit is required to bring a legal malpractice action. This is often true in the context of medical malpractice actions, that in the context of a medical malpractice action, you need an affidavit of merit from a doctor to say that there's merit to this cause of action, there's merit to this claim. And that is sometimes true in the context of legal malpractice cases in some states. Most states, I believe, do not require an affidavit of merit since there's an attorney bringing the action on behalf of the plaintiff. That essentially constitutes the affidavit of merit that there's an attorney that's handling this case that looked at this, and from his or her perspective, there was malpractice. So most states don't require an affidavit of merit on a legal malpractice claim, but some states do. As far as, again, burdens of proof on the issues of, we discussed the elements, negligence, proximate cause, damages, those things, obviously are burdens for the plaintiff. We discussed some issues that could be affirmative defenses that may be burdens for the attorney. And of course, in the context of a motion for summary judgment or a motion to dismiss, when an attorney's trying to demonstrate that there was some valid defense, that there wouldn't have prevailed in the underlying case, there's no issue of proximate cause, whatever it may be, obviously on the motion for summary judgment or motion to dismiss, the burden of proof in that circumstance is on the attorney. And finally is the issue of expert testimony. Generally speaking, in the context of a legal malpractice action, expert testimony is going to be required for the plaintiff to prove legal malpractice. There are some limited exceptions to that. For example, if the generally where the expert is required an expert is not required generally if the issue is within the knowledge of the fact finder. So you might in most cases, you'll need a plaintiff will need a legal expert in order to demonstrate the legal malpractice of an attorney. But if it's something so basic and simple, for example, as a blown statute of limitations, that if you're before a jury, that an attorney, a plaintiff in that context, is likely not going to need a specific expert to demonstrate that was legal malpractice for the attorney to not file the action timely. That's something so basic that it's within the knowledge of the jury that you might not need an expert for something as basic as that. But for most other issues that are more more complicated than that, issues that are particular to areas of law and all those things, in order for the plaintiff to establish the legal malpractice of the attorney, they're generally going to need a legal expert in order to establish that. So those are just some issues to keep in mind that go along with the issues of malpractice and the elements and defenses of them as well. So that's basically everything on legal malpractice actions in general, elements, claims, and defenses. Again, my name is William McCaffrey. I'm with the law firm Labatt, Balkin, Colavita, and Contini in New York. Again, as I mentioned earlier, issues vary from state to state, so if you have any particular issues, you should research the issues in your state or contact an attorney who does these things. If you have any questions or want additional information, you can certainly contact me. My website is www.lbcclaw.com. My phone number is 516-837-7369. My email address is wmccaffery@lbcclaw.com. And my information is also on the materials as well. So thank you for participating in this, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much.